Bible kind of sitting here. I have all kinds of thoughts. When I went to MTA, I'm actually my sons are third generation. My father's first generation, so I have a lot of Akar Zatov to MTA and Rabbi Taubes and Rabbi Kahn, who's doing a really phenomenal job now. I'm going to tell you just a quick little story. And I work at Eshet Torah. It's kind of neat having an office address, One Kotel Plaza. And when I first started there, I decided the first couple of weeks I would just hang out in the old city, and specifically Friday nights around the Kotel to see what was going on, the give or take. It's always crowded. There's a ton of people there. And the first Friday night,
I'm there. The sessions are now ready to begin.
Awesome.
Everyone, please take their places.
Okay. I'll start from the beginning. Anyway, so I'm down at the Kotel. I go to the first Friday night, and I'm looking around. I see this huge group of Sephardic Jews at the back of the Kotel Plaza. And I realize I recognize some of them, and they were Mashadi Jews, right? It's a type of Persian Jews from Great Neck. And I had been a scholar in residence in the Mashadi community, so I knew some of them. I was schmoozing with them. Turns out they had 26 bar mitzvahs that year in their community, and 800 of them came to Israel together to celebrate, right? Incredibly close-knit community. So we were schmoozing, and then, you know, afterwards, when you head out of the Kotel, the two staircases that lead away from the Kotel are always jam-packed with people. So I offered my friends, you know, I have a building, we have the only private entrance to the Kotel Plaza. I said, well, just walk through my building, and you get right to the Rova. So myself and 800 of my newfound friends walked through my building. I pointed out the donor plaques on the way up the staircase. It worked out well for all of us. We get to the top, walk out of the old city, walk them all the way back to the Plaza Hotel. Once we get there, they say, Rabbi, the kavod, you should join us for the Suda. You came all the way with us. I said, no problem. Didn't have any other plans. I was going to go join a birthright group in the building. So we go, we sit down, and you know, my friend turns to me, he said, Rabbi, bechavod, you should make kiddush. I said, look, tonight I'm Mashadi, right? Whatever you do, that's what I'm doing. I'm just going to go with the flow. He goes, okay, great. So he makes kiddush, and when he's done, he hands the kos to his father to drink. His father picks up a teaspoon, takes a little bit of the wine, and he sips it. And then he hands it to me. I'm looking around. I pick up my teaspoon, I take a little sip of it, he leans forward and says, no, that's not Mashadi, he's a germ freak, it's not, you know. So, I have been very blessed to learn from so many people coming through there, and what I'd like to do today is go through a couple points just in terms of, and I'll get to the Mormon piece, I know that's in my title, it's probably why most of you came. Just talking a little bit about teens, how to make them passionate, what we really need to do for them, and it really applies to all Jews, but I think especially to them. One of the things I pointed out in kind of the description in your brochure was the fact that God is very clear that someone becomes a young man or young woman at age 12 or 13. That is when they start to think. Now, they're not a complete adult because we know that age 20, kares sets in. You don't go to the army until age 20. There are many other deadlines that come up later on. But certainly at that point, when they start to think, we have to make a very strong case for Judaism. And we're going to talk about that. Couple different points, utilizing Divrei Torah to get us there, because I think that we have to make sure that the stuff we want to upkeep Judaism, you know, the core of Judaism is the Torah, and we're gonna try and use that. I'd like to start just by talking about the Rambam. You know, the Rambam is a great book of halacha, and there's certain parts where he starts to get a little historical. And there's one point in Avodas Kochavim where he starts to talk about the advent of monotheism, right? Where the belief in one God came from. And one of the things he points out is that Abraham was not the first monotheist. He was not the first person to believe in one God. And the Rambam lists out Noach, Chanoch, Methuselah, Shem Ve'ever. There's a whole host of a few people that all believed in the Ribbono Shel Olam, in one God. And then he says Abraham comes along and he calls him Amudo Shel Olam. Right, the pillar of the world comes, right, Abraham Avinu. Right, he busts up the idols and he, you know, makes a stand for God, and that's kind of how the Jews popped on the scene. Now the Ravid, very interestingly, kind of jumps right in here and he asks a very, very, very powerful question. The Ravid says, I don't understand. Shem Ve'ever, we know traditionally, had a yeshiva, right? It's yeshiva Shem Ve'ever. It's a very famous yeshiva, right, where Yaakov, many other people studied. He said, if Shem Ve'ever had a yeshiva, why is Abraham the one that broke up all the idols? And why is Abraham the one that we know is the father of really Judaism? Why wasn't it Shane Bateman? Why didn't they take that stand? So he gives an answer, and the truth be told, the question is a lot better than the answer. His answer is maybe Shane Bateman didn't know about the idols, which is really kind of hard to stomach considering how widespread idolatry was. So the Kesef Mishnah jumps up and says, I will explain you exactly why it could not have been Shane Bateman, and it had to be Avram. He said, what was going on in Yeshiva Shane Bateman? He said it probably was a room just like this, really beautiful room. They had bookshelves, they had all kinds of things written about monotheism, God. People would sit, they would learn, they would study. He says, but if you were outside of this room, if you were on the other side of that door on the street, and you didn't know what was inside, you didn't know the secret knock or handshake, you didn't know how to get inside, you would never know what was going on inside. It was only for the privileged few. And he says, Avram Avinu was so obsessed and tin with God that everywhere he would go, he would grab people by lapels, he would shake them up, he would scream and yell that there's a God, how could you not understand this? Of course he broke the idols because he couldn't take it. He needed the world to know at the great risk of his own life. Everywhere he went, he was telling the story. And it is if Judaism at one point in time could have gone two different ways. Judaism could have been a very insular religion where there's a few of us that kind of know this little secret. That was the Judaism of Shem Ve'Eber. And then there was this other Judaism, Avram Avinu, that everyone in the world needs to know about God and who and what we are. And this was God's decision that it had to come from Avram Avinu. And the question is, why? Why did Judaism have to be this outreach religion where we would extend our hands? So many people talk about the advent of outreach in the last 40 or 50 years. Right? Really, it's been going on for thousands of years. Our whole religion is based on it. Why? Why did God choose Avram's derech over Shem Dever? So I'll tell you when it really hit me. It hit me when I was talking to a Mormon friend of mine. So I did a lot of lobbying in my career at different times, state, city, federal levels. And one of the things when you do lobbying is you tend to hang out with some of the faith-based groups, right? The Catholics, the Mormons. There's a bunch of groups that have very good lobbying shops, good people. And you spend time with them. There are a lot of issues, whether it be educational funding, freedom of religion, all kinds of things that are important to the communities. So I was talking to a Mormon friend of mine, and we were talking about how it's a little bit similar. You know, we send kids to Israel, seminary, yeshiva for a year or two. They send them on shlichus for 2 or 3 years. Right? Recently, I went to South Africa, Johannesburg. Literally on my plane, right in front of me, I had a bunch of young men with, you know, black ties, white shirts, glasses, heading to Africa to proselytize, and that's what the Mormons do. They send out post-high school all around the world. So I asked my friend a basic question. I said, could you tell me, what is your success rate, right? You're sending out thousands of people, your children around the world to proselytize and bring back converts. How many converts do they bring home? And he said, to the truth be told, we don't really know. So what do you mean you don't know? You're spending millions of dollars sending out all of your children around the world and you have no idea if you're being successful? He says, we don't do it for the converts. We do it for our kids. He said, if our kids go door to door for a year or two, just talking about the religion, defending their religion, having people ask them questions, having to give you, when they show up back at home, they are so strong in everything they believe. And I thought to myself, I kind of jumped in my mind from the Mormons to Chabad. Because so many times around the world, you'll interact with a Chabad member. Where did you grow up? Thailand. Right? Where did you grow up? In the far ranges of the world. But they were brought up around a table where they constantly had to explain and defend, right? And to show people who and what we are. And I think first and foremost, this is something that is so important to the nature of our community. Is on the one hand, we want to educate our children. On the one hand, we want to give them all those pieces to use. But on the other hand, they have to be questioned. They have to be able to explain and articulate what they believe. If we were to round up some of our kids and say to them, tell me what being a Jew means to you, I think that they would have a tough time. And the way that you can refine it is to have to explain it. Right? And I can give examples after examples where, you know, throughout my career, I saw this happen, you know, and so many times, I think Rabbi Sachs alluded to this, talking about leadership, When people are in those leadership roles, it you have to articulate or else you can't be a leader. And I think that's a major piece of what we need to do, is we need to figure out. And so I would call this as point number one, we need to help our children have deep belief. And belief just doesn't come by sitting back and passively listening. That's a part of it. But it comes by explaining. Right? We have to have people at our Shabbos tables. You know, I tell people all the time, we started something in Eshet Torah called Project Inspire. And Project Inspire was basically, it's called Wake the Sleeping Giant. We were going to go to the Orthodox community and say, hey, we're only 10% of the Jews here in America. You got to go out and you got to reach out to your brothers and sisters. And so we started these big conventions and this big movement. And you know what we found? We said, everyone's going to come. We're going to train them to go back out. We found that the Orthodox Jews were coming to get inspired themselves. And what we also found, that the best way for them to inspire themselves was by inspiring others. One thing can't really work without the other. I want to move on from that for a moment to talk for a second about what I think is important point number two. And this, I want to give you a Dvar Torah that I shared. This is probably the most awkward position I've ever been in my entire career. I used to spend a lot of time in Germany, a lot of friends there in the Lauder Foundation. There was a time when I worked for NCSY, and if you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there were about 100,000 Jews that kind of got picked up and dropped into Germany. I mean, you had communities that probably had 50 or 100 Jews that overnight had 1,500, 2,000 Jews. Right? Why? Because the Germans, due to German guilt, gave great economic packages to the Jews of Russia, and so they started to flood in. Right? Until Israel caught wind of it, got really upset, and asked Germany to stop giving money to Soviet Jews. Way more complicated conversation to have how that worked out. But the bottom line is all these Jews were coming to Germany and they were assimilating. And so we worked with the Lauder Foundation, NCSY, we translated the NCSY venture into German, Hungarian, and we did a lot of work there. And one of the things they did is Rabbi Josh Spinner, head of the Lauder Foundation, he built a yeshiva and he started to train rabbis that spoke German, that spoke the native language, to be able to go out and reach out. So I had, right, we were there together, my father, right, we went to the first ordination, rabbinical ordination of Orthodox rabbis in Germany since before World War II. Right, it took place in Munich. It was an unbelievable ceremony. It was not a dry eye in the house. To me, I remember the one kind of point, we were sitting there and the Minister of the Interior was speaking. The guy who was in charge of the Gestapo at one point was talking about how great it was to have rabbis back in Germany. It was a very surreal kind of moment. And then they did a second Chag HaSmicha, which was in Leipzig. I went to that one too. And then they did a third one in Cologne, and I went to the third one. And for that one, my friend Rabbi Spinner asked me, he said, would you speak? And I said, sure, no problem. And they, of course, you know, this being Germany, they had arranged everything like a year in advance. Everything is coordinated. And a few weeks before we get to Cologne, there is a judgment in the local court that says that circumcision should be banned due to pain to the baby. All right? So here we are in Germany being told that one of our strongest commandments can no longer happen. Right? And I asked a friend of mine, Stefan Kramer, who was the head of the Jewish community in Germany, and I asked him, I said, you know, is there any anti-Semitism involved with this? He said, well, let me tell you, put it to you this way. He said, seeing a guy with a shaved head, a swastika tattoo, talk about the pain to the baby is a little awkward. Those are the kinds of things you see in Germany. Anyway, so we're all coming down there, and I've got to give it Dvar Torah. And there's like this elephant in the room. There's like a herd of elephants in the room, right? Here we are. In fact, they were so concerned, they sent the defense minister to speak also there, is being broadcast live on. So what do you say in Germany when all this is going on? So I gave the following Dvar Torah. I talked about the fact that we've been persecuted so many times throughout the years. And there was one time in our history where Jews were literally being killed in the streets. And a family had to make a decision whether to keep a child in their home or to place the child with a Gentile family, to put the child up basically for adoption, hide him away as a Gentile. And even though that the child wouldn't know about their Jewish roots, they would be alive. So they made that decision. We can't really judge it because we haven't been in that situation. But they put the Jewish child in a non-Jewish home. Child grows up, has money, wealth, good education, everything going for the child. And then at some point, the child finds out that they're Jewish. And at that point, they have to make a decision whether to rejoin us or to stay where everything is warm and cozy. And the child makes the fateful decision to rejoin the Jewish people. And we are forever grateful because that child was Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Moshe did not grow up in the Jewish home. Right? Moshe did not grow up in a Jewish home. He comes back to take the Jewish people out. And of course, he kills the Egyptian, runs off, winds up being a shepherd, and that is where he meets God at the burning bush. And God tells Moshe, "Moshe, I need you to go back, save the Jews." Moshe says, "No way, I'm not going back." He says, "You got to go back. I don't want to go right." And back and forth, back and forth. And there's one point where Moshe says, "Okay, wait a minute. If I go back, which one of your names should I use?" And God says, "Oh, that's simple. Use Ekeh Asher Ekeh, right? What'll be is what'll be, right? Famous in the famous Ten Commandments movie, I am what I am, right? What'll be is what'll be." And then they go back to the story, the back and forth, and what's clear is that both Moshe and Hashem know the give and take of that question answer. What's also clear is that you and I don't have a clue what he's talking about. We never heard of this name. We don't know why he needs a name. It's like this weird kind of bizarre back and forth right in the middle of this whole conversation. So the Esh Kodesh, many of you know the shul named after him in Woodmere, the Esh Kodesh, who was killed, who was a rabbi in the ghetto. And this Dvar Torah, I always refer to as the Holy Dvar Torah, because we have it because this is a drusha he gave in the ghetto. And we have it because his writings were put in milk bottles and they were dug up by construction workers. And that's why we have this here today. And he says that there are two ways in which we view ourselves. There's the present, right? We're sitting in this library, right? Discussing. And there's the past, where I went to school, my family, everything that got me to this moment. The Esh Kodesh says there is a third way to view our lives, which we rarely use, and that is the future, who we will become. And he says that's what God was telling Moshe. Moshe, I get it. You're a shepherd in the desert. You don't think you can do this, but you need to know what potential you have, Moshe. And when you go to the Jews and they said, we've been slaves for so long, we don't know what freedom is, you need to tell them what kind of great nation they could become. And when I mentioned this in Germany, I mentioned the fact that these young rabbis were going to go out and you could tell us that we can't circumcise our children. It ain't going to make a bit of difference. We've been doing it for thousands of years and people tougher than you have tried to stop us. But I think for ourselves and our teens, that is a major point for us to understand. They need to know who they can become. Who are their role models? Who are they looking up to? I'll never forget, I used to go for NCSY. I used to speak in 30 schools in 4 days in Israel. It was a Monday through Thursday trip. I used to go every day to 8-9 schools, and I used to pitch everyone that they should become NCSY advisors. And I used to go school to school to school. And I went one time to Michlala. I remember I was dating the girls in Michlala, and afterwards one of the girls from Chicago came up to me and said, I'm a public school kid. I went to, it was a JSU club, it's a Jewish student union, the club of my public school, and I wanted to go to Israel, I came to Michlala. Now, I don't know how much you know about this, I know a lot about this. If you're a public school kid, and you want to go to Michlala, you have no life your senior year in high school. They make you get tutors, they make you study, there is a curriculum. They literally, you have to just give up anything remotely fun your senior year to make it to go to Michlala as a public school kid. So I asked her, I said, like, why would you kill you? There's so many places you could have gone. Why would you have worked so hard to get here? And she looked at me like I was crazy. She said, what are you talking about? My advisor, Nancy Swy, who was this stern girl, right, had gone to Michlala, so of course I was going to go to Michlala, because I want to be like her. And those role models are so important, who we hold up as role models. And by the opposite's also true, meaning, you know, I had this minhag one time, we were in L.A., and people like to talk about schools, they like to talk about shuls, they like to talk about rabbis and teach all that, right? And I said at one meal that we had two families over, and I said to my wife, I said, you know what, every time they bring up the local school situation, I'm just going to sing Yogzim Mavuba. Okay, I sang it 8 times, right? And that's something we have to be very careful. I mean, on the one hand, I'm giving you the positive role models, but you have to be very careful. We have conversations about principals, about teachers, about rabbis, you know, and then we send our children to school to learn from people that they know we have no respect for. That's complicated. And we need to be very, very, very careful. So I would say the first one, as we said, is emunah, belief, teaching our children what they believe. And the second one is potential, to know who they could become, to know who we put up in a pedestal. The third one I want to discuss, and this really comes from the Torah. I want to talk about for a moment the first shidduch in the Torah. Right, I'll get there, by the way. It's not a YU Connects class, but I think it'll be important for our teens. So the first shidduch in the Torah, you know, we don't really know Avram Sarah met, right? They were not Jewish at the time, some party, we don't really know what happened there. Somehow they met. But when it comes time for Yitzchak, right, Avram pulls Eliezer aside, says, Eliezer, I need you to go find a girl for my son Yitzchak. Right? Eliezer, the warrior, the servant, says, no problem, I got it. Walks outside and says, oh my, I have no idea what I'm doing, right? No idea how to do this. So he makes a deal with God. He says, look, God, I'm going to go down there, right, to where Avram's from. Someone brings me out water, my camel's water. The shidduch's done, we're good. Shows up, and you know the story, little Rivka comes out, she gives him water, camel's water, the shidduch is made. I always had a question. If you read the commentaries, it says that he didn't go down empty-handed. He had 10 camels laden down with gold and silver and spices and silk, and, right? Like, he was loaded. So he played out in more of a modern-day circumstance, right? You have a kind of stretch Hummer limo pull up, the window goes down, little $100 bills go flittering out into the air, and a young bachelorette says, can I buy you a drink? That happens quite often on this island of Manhattan here, right? What? That's the sign? Right? Guys show up a lot of money, someone is nice to him? So you have to look at the verses to understand what's going on there. It says, when she comes out, batimaher, batarux. Over and over again, you see the verbs, maher and rux, that they hurry, right? They're running. You feel like you're watching and fast forward. She's hurrying, he's hurrying, back and forth and back and forth. There was passion. It wasn't Eliezer just saw that she brought him the water. He saw how she did it. You know, we could be sitting at home and talking to our children, right, and say, oh, could you bring me a glass of water? And there are two ways that can happen. You know, my friends, let's go out, I'm watching, you know, oh, here's your water, and you spill half. Right? The second way is, right, oh, here's the water, can I get you a sandwich, anything else I can do for you, right? Now, you've done the same thing, you've gotten the same water, but you haven't. How did Eliezer know that's what he should be looking for? So if you go back, when Avram is sitting at the tent opening, right? And the three Malachim come there. What verbs do you find? Vayarutz vayemaher. That Avram ran, they rushed, the whole tent was in a frenzy. Judaism was built on passion. And I will go as far as to say that Judaism does not work without passion. If people are not passionate about Judaism, it won't make it down the generations. It's that excitement. It's that excitement that we have to have, our children have to have. Anytime something happens, it has to be exciting. It can't just be, and this is, I think, one of the major issues that we are up against as a nation, is something called social orthodoxy. And by the way, it applies to the modern Orthodox community, the Hasidic community, the Yeshivish community, and any other community within the Orthodox world. It becomes a point in time where we have gone so long, quote unquote, without a genocide, or we've had it a lot better than we've had in many years, where our new generations are Jewish and Orthodox even, but they don't have a connection to God. They're Orthodox because I'm comfortable here. I grew up in an Orthodox shul. I'm going to stay in an Orthodox shul. Right? I'll never forget, I had a young woman from an all-girls high school once tell me, she said, look, I can explain you all the intricate details and laws of Boer. I'm just not sure I believe in God. And that is the challenge of our community right now. The challenge of our community is someone could be in our community, they can go to shul on Shabbos, they can do all these things, but not be tethered to God. That doesn't last. That will not make it generation after generation. It can't work that way. And as I said before, this is everyone. This is not just our community. This is across the Orthodox world. It is something that we are up against. So we need to teach passionate Judaism to our children. The last point I'd like to make, actually, from these kind of last week's Parsha, you know, Yaakov, it's really, really amazing. You know, Yaakov runs away from his brother trying to kill him, to his father-in-law trying to kill him, back to his brother trying to kill him. You know, I always tell Jewish leaders that the best thing that they can do, and politicians, is read over the book of Samuel, Shmuel, over and over again, right? Because David has his father-in-law chase him to kill him. At the end, his son tries to kill him. In between the Plishtim, wherever there's a little break, they jump in there, right? Very, very tough life, Yaakov. So Yaakov, this week, of course, prepared to go to war with Esav. And the thing that he says to Esav is, right, Im lovam garti, v'tarav mitzvah shamarti. Understand, Esav, even though I was gone, And even though I was living with a horrible, horrific human being, a terrible, anti-God person, I still serve God. So any spiritual leg up you thought you had on me, you don't got it. Now the question is, even though he was still solid in his commandments, was Yaakov the same person from beginning to end, staying with Laban? And my Rebbe, Rabbi Rubel, who I had him at a seder many years ago, once pointed out that in the beginning of last week's Parsha, there's a dream. And that's the dream of angels, right? The dream of Yaakov seeing angels going up and down. At the end of spending all those years with Laban, he has another dream that people kind of gloss over. He has a dream about speckled, spotted, striped sheep. That's how he made his money. He kept making deals with Laban. I'll get the spotted sheep, the speckled sheep, right? Yaakov Avinu, on his way down, when he learns the Yeshiva Shev Aaron's dream of angels, after spending 20 years with Laban, he's dreaming about money. And at that point in time, he comes to Rachel and Leah and says, we got to get out of here. It is true that Laban's sons, you know, were not happy, Laban, etc. But he also, in the conversation, he mentions that dream to Rachel and Leah. He says, we got to go. And then when Laban confronts him, and this I heard from Rabbi Lamb. This was, I went to YU Smicha. I'll never forget, we were invited at the end of YU Smicha to the fifth floor to have dinner with him. I don't know, it's kind of like being like one of those science fiction books. No one ever went to the fifth floor. Like getting an invitation up there was like, you know, you're looking around, you know? But I'll never forget what he said to us. He asked the question that when Yaakov flees from Laban, Laban tracks him down, and Laban confronts him and searches the idols, comes up empty, Yaakov gets really angry, really cries, he gets angry, he's really upset. And he starts giving it to Laban. He says, what is he so upset about? He's finally lost it. Laban 20 years, he switches wife, and now he's lost it? He said he wasn't angry at Laban. He was angry at himself. He said he saw that Laban, look at the lengths that Laban will go through for these little idols that mean nothing. He says, why don't I serve God the same way? He's upset at his own avodas Hashem. And to me, that was so powerful. You know, we look around the world today. There are people, whether it be, and at the time he had talked about, this was many years ago, radical Islam and people that will blow themselves up for their God, you know, for all kind of false gods, all terrible things, right? But we should have also passion, right? We should have passion. Obviously not doing the same horrible things, but passion for the real true God. We should serve him. And I remember when I first got to Manhattan, and I went to work downtown. I remember, all of a sudden it occurred to me one day that I had friends that were lawyers. And I could pick up the phone at 3 a.m. and like call their office and they would pick up because they were in the middle of a deal, you know? And I remember thinking at the time, that that's like a little bit insane. But once I got past that, I thought to myself, why don't I have that same dedication to God? Right? Why am I not in my office till 3 a.m. when 90% of the Jewish people has walked out the door? All the issues we're facing with Israel now, and we're very involved in it, in our organization, we have Hasbro Fellowship, we go campus to campus, educating Jewish kids how to fight for Israel. If we would reach out to these Jews, forget 90%, if we get another 10% on our side, everything would change. And so I think that these four points, the first is emun and belief. And the way to get to belief is not tell someone to believe it, have them express it, articulate it, speak about it, be challenged. The second was potential, is for our children to understand who they could become, right? I just said recently, I was at Bar Mitzvah last week, and I basically told the Bar Mitzvah boy, I said, the day you were born, I said, your dad and I became the past and you became the future. And we need to really let our children know that. Three is passion. Without passion, the religion just doesn't work. It's the fuel in our engine. And finally, atmosphere, right? The fact that living with love takes its toll. And we have to make sure that ourselves and our children are in an atmosphere where we can grow. Thank you.